Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Alaska's recent special election produced a rare win for a Democrat rather than a Republican for the state's congressional seat. How much of that election had to do with the voting process known as ranked choice voting? How exactly does that process work? And what are its implications for democracy? And first, how much have voting districts been gerrymandered, and how might that affect the upcoming midterm elections? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Gerrymandering has a long tradition in the United States. The nature of districts being redrawn every 10 years based on census data has raised concerns about who controls the process and how democratic is this process. State legislatures have traditionally controlled districting, but there's a real decentralization of the process and decision-making as to how they're drawn. And in recent years, technology has enabled a more complex system of so-called gerrymandering that can challenge the principles of democracy by overrepresenting minority party rule. So on today's show, we examine redistricting, the practice of gerrymandering, and its impacts on the upcoming election. Our panel today is Seth McKee, a professor of political science at Oklahoma State University. He's the author of The Intersection of Redistricting, Race, and Participation, Political Conditions and the Electoral Effects of Redistricting and Redistricting Does Little to Change Which Party People Vote For, and Which Can Make Partisan Gerrymandering More Effective. And Christian Gross, professor of political science and public policy at the University of Southern California. He is the co-author of The Worst Partisan Gerrymanders in U.S. State Legislatures, A New Form of Gerrymandering Using CVAP and Independent Redistricting Commissions Increase Voter Perceptions of Fairness. Thank you both very much for joining us. This is particularly timely considering the midterm elections are coming up, and we've just had some redistricting, some redrawing. Christian Gross, we hear this term gerrymandering. What do we mean by gerrymandering? Kind of what's its history?
Yeah, thanks, Doug. Great question. And gerrymandering is basically using the redrawing of lines to create some sort of political advantage. There's different kinds of gerrymandering, but usually we talk about partisan gerrymandering. So if Republicans are in charge of a state legislature and that legislature is redrawing its congressional districts or its state legislative districts, and they go way overboard for the Republicans, that's Republican gerrymandering. If a Democratic legislature does the same thing, that's Democratic gerrymandering. So gerrymandering is generally like trying to draw the lines to favor some group or party. You can also have gerrymandering that's racial, where you're engaging in redistricting and redrawing of congressional and state legislative lines that could empower racial groups or actually harm racial groups. And so that's another component of it as well. But usually when people say gerrymandering, they mean favoring one party or the other.
And Seth McKee, I know you've written about the racial elements of gerrymandering. A lot of the conversation seems to suggest that partisan gerrymandering and racial gerrymandering may not be as separate of an issue as sometimes we might consider. Are the two linked?
Yeah, they often are, especially these days. And a lot of the reason for that is because of the sorting of the two parties. Because minorities, African Americans in particular, align so heavily with the Democratic Party, when Republicans gerrymander, they often want to concentrate as many Blacks into a single district as they can because those are the most Democratic voters. And so the case law on redistricting is still really murky in terms of what you can and can't do. And so if we look at this, sometimes Republicans can get away with this kind of gerrymandering by saying, well, we're not really looking at race. We're furthering a partisan gerrymander, and race just happens to be part of the objective. And if that's the way you do it, sometimes those partisan gerrymanders are upheld because there really is no law that says you can't partisan gerrymander. What you can't do is racial gerrymander at times.
And Seth, I want to follow this up. I've heard these concepts called packing and cracking when it comes to those districts. What do those terms mean?
Yeah, and so it doesn't necessarily have to be in the racial context, but historically, like if you look at the American South and you think about the word cracking, look at a state like Mississippi, where you have so many African Americans in what we call the Mississippi Delta, right, the northwestern part of the state. And so what you did after the Voting Rights Act, when African Americans could now vote, is you would crack these districts. So you would spread out African Americans so their votes diluted and there's more white voters in every one of those districts. And so that's the example of cracking. Packing would say, okay, take Mississippi again. And what we'll do is we'll try to draw a district that concentrates most of the African Americans in one or two districts. That way their power is diluted. Even if you put them in one, it might be the case that at that time in American history that the white candidate might win because of greater white participation. So cracking and packing are very common ways to gerrymander and get an advantage.
And Christian Gross, the notion of gerrymander, what comes to mind are these bizarrely drawn districts, right? Any sort of natural geographic connections, including cities, you know, possibly even divided up into two or three, you know, the different districts, or obviously in California it might be even more than that. I guess theoretically, the idea of geographic representation, which is kind of at its, you know, the core of democratic representation in the U.S., are we falsely assuming that the geography is something that's contiguous, that there's some sort of geographic unit that is the best way to draw that representation?
Yeah, I think it depends. I think a lot of people, when they're looking at partisan or racial gerrymanders, the Supreme Court has done this. They'll look at something that, you know, I've written about this. I think Seth has written about this. North Carolina drew a district back in the 1990s that went from Charlotte to Durham. It was the length of a freeway in the state, and it just looked really bad, right? And so, you know, you can look at them sometimes and think, well, geographically, this has got to be a gerrymander. But I'm a little nervous to say it's all about geography. You can actually use geography to cover what's a really egregious gerrymander, right? Like, so with the technology now, you can draw maps that look really pretty, but are really, really terrible gerrymanders. And so I don't think that geography by itself is it entirely. The other thing is, like, the US, we use, you know, outside of a few state legislative districts, we use single member districts. One person wins in the district, so you do have to draw a line. Sometimes the districts don't look that pretty for good reasons. Like, so in California, we have criteria that you have to use, and geographic compactness is actually pretty low. So pretty districts is kind of low. What's more important is protecting voting rights of, you know, Latino, Asian American, and Black voters. That's a very high criteria that the Redistricting Commission has to use. Some other criteria regarding, you know, municipalities. So some of our municipalities look crazy shapes, and you draw them in, you got to draw a district that goes and takes in the Channel Islands or Catalina Island, and it's not going to look pretty, but it might actually make sense. And so sometimes, you know, you've got districts that are drawn for really good reasons that are not geographically compact or geographically nice. There's one in the, not to get too in the weeds, but in the Central Valley of California, which is a very polarized place, where white voters tend to support some candidates and Latino voters tend to support other candidates. Latino voters have regularly been disfranchised through the redistricting process for the last several decades. And this year, the commission drew a district that, you know, kind of has a hook that takes in a Latino community near Bakersfield and is probably going to empower Latino voters in a way that had not been done for decades. And it might not be the prettiest, most round or square district, but there's a really good reason in the Constitution of California, the Redistricting Commission, to draw the district that way. So that's a long way of saying geographic compactness is a good goal, but not the only goal. And you really need to think about voting rights and protection of communities of interest, and people of color in particular, when that's under the Voting Rights Act. And then there's other reasons too that the districts just might not look very good.
Sounds like there's a little bit of a quandary there. Christian, I'll follow up with you and ask Seth the same thing, because I know you've both written on this. You can't racially gerrymander, but you actually highlighted areas of traditionally underrepresented groups, and that needs to be under consideration, at least in this California process. How do you square that circle? You're not supposed to take race into consideration, but you are precisely supposed to take race into consideration, or at least underrepresentation of groups.
Yeah, I mean, right now, the Voting Rights Act Section 2 is the law. It's been in place in its current form pretty much since it was revised in the 1980s. There is a court case next month that may change or overturn it. But right now, you are supposed to take race into account enough if you're living in a place where voters of color and white voters vote very differently, and white voters win all the time. So that one place I gave as an example, white voters win all the time. The districts have been drawn for decades where white voters' preferred candidate always beats Latino voters' preferred candidates, or almost always. And the data show that. And it's a really data-driven process that's legal. So you can't just go and draw a district based on racial or ethnic reasons because you feel like it. You have to go through all of this data analysis. Are voters of color losing regularly? Could you draw a district differently where voters of color could win? And you have to check all these boxes, or else you can't use race. And if those criteria don't match, you can't consider race at all. And so in that case, it's not a racial gerrymander in the Central Valley. It's actually required by law under the Voting Rights Act to do that. And then there's also some good community of interest reasons that you might want to do that in California that came out during the commission process. The other thing that what Seth was talking about, so like a racial gerrymander is actually just literally packing Black voters into a district for no good reason, right? Other than to dilute the power of Black voting strength or to try to give some advantage to white voters, or the alternative, splitting Black voters down the middle, like in Alabama, Montgomery, Alabama, very large Black population. There's two white majority districts right now, split the Black population in Montgomery in half. You could draw the district differently. And that would probably help empower Black voters. And I would say it's probably a racial gerrymander having cracked in that particular case while packing Black voters into one district in Alabama. And so you can't use race if there's no good reason, but once you've done all these data-oriented criteria as laid out by the Supreme Court in 1986, you can actually take race into account.
Seth McKee, I don't know if you'd like to follow up on that as well.
Yeah, that's right. The Thornburg v. Jingles case, 1986, North Carolina case. And essentially, yeah, you can use race, assuming that the racial population is very large and geographically compact. And so if you establish that's the case, and then furthermore, that racial voting is highly polarized, then those are the prongs of that test, essentially, to allow for a majority-minority district. But as Christian said, you know, when we think about racial gerrymandering, we're often thinking about these districts that really do look crazy because the objective is to get a majority minority. And it doesn't satisfy that one prong, which is it's not geographically compact at all. And so that's when we really see these crazy looking districts like the one Christian mentioned, the I-85 district. District 12 in North Carolina, a lot of the time that was a number. I mean, in the 1990s, this stuff went rampant because essentially with preclearance under the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, the Department of Justice overseeing these districts mainly drawn in southern United States, you actually had Democrats in charge who were trying to save their majorities. And the only way they figured they could do it was to make these crazy districts where they didn't really harm their white voters that still voted Democratic at the time. And of course, it actually backfired because when you put a lot of whites in districts with a different Democratic incumbent, lo and behold, they voted Republican because a smart Republican would show up, or a strategic one, or both, and run against the Democratic incumbent because they knew there were a bunch of constituents that were new to the district. And so that kind of thing happened all over the South. And we started calling it a dummy mander. Bernie Grofman and Tom Brunell talked about this, and it just didn't work, right? Because voters were not constant in their preferences. When you change the district boundaries, it changed their behavior. And so they started voting Republican at an accelerated rate.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the issue of gerrymandering and redistricting in the United States with Seth McKee of Oklahoma State University and Christian Gross of the University of Southern California. Christian, I guess the next question that comes to mind for me then is, we've been talking a lot about the actual, you know, the results, the outputs, but there's a process question here, I suppose, as well, which is, you're describing the court telling legislatures what they can do. Who actually controls the process of drawing these districts, and is that changing?
Yeah, that's a good question. In most of the states, the state legislature redraws their own lines. And so voters hate that. It sounds terrible, right? Legislators get to redraw their own lines. So they often protect themselves. They protect their party, whichever party's in charge. You know, Oklahoma, it's run by Republican state legislators. They draw districts that screw over Democrats. And, you know, you probably could draw one Democratic-leaning congressional district in Oklahoma if you wanted to, but they do not, and they did not, right? And then the same thing when Democrats control things, like in New York, Democrats drew a really, the legislators in New York are controlled by the Democrats, and they drew really pro-Democratic map as well that ended up getting thrown out by the courts. But you, in most of the states, the legislature's in charge and they redraw their own lines and they redraw congressional lines. But then there's a few states that in the last 20 years have adopted independent commissions or some form of commissions. And that would be like California and Michigan and Colorado and a few other places. Arizona has a fairly independent commission. And so those are different processes, but the way it works in California and Michigan is citizens apply to become commissioners. There's different processes. And then California, for instance, there are 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, 4 independents who serve, and they redraw the lines. And I find, you know, based on some analysis I've done in the past and also some analysis I'm doing now, that the commission states tend to be a little bit more open to these arguments about communities of interest that might exist, be they racial groups or other groups or geographic communities, that legislators would just ignore. Because if the legislators don't care, they want to protect themselves. While, you know, the commissions, there's still politics involved in the commissions, but they're going to be listening a little bit more to community input than you're going to see if you have legislators, right? You know, like some states, so California, for instance, in 2001, is the last time the legislature had control over drawing the lines. They passed a map the day after September 11, 2001 on purpose because nobody was paying attention. It was a terrible day after the tragedy of September 11th. And they drew lines that protected themselves. They drew lines that protected white Democrats. White Democrats are in the legislature splitting Asian and Latino communities all over the state. And then the commission came in a decade later and then was done again in 2021. And the maps that legislators would have drawn changed. The commission was kind of messy, but they spent months on meetings, taking in public comments and inputs. And it's just a very different process that even if the map comes out a little bit quirky, there's way more opportunity for citizen input when the commissions are in charge.
By the way, quick follow-up. It's my perception that the commission states tend to be blue states. Is there a correlation there?
Well, I don't think so entirely. So, I mean, Michigan is pretty much a swing state. California is a blue state, but when the commission came in, it was a Republican turning into a Democratic state. So it was actually not that Democratic when it was passed. And then Arizona has had it for a while, and it's Republican, maybe becoming Democratic, and, you know, or at least purple. So it does tend to be, my take on it is a little bit more is that they start in initiative states, Western states, places where all of these have been put on the ballot via ballot initiative and voters vote for it. Very rarely do we see legislators voting to remove their power to draw their own lines, and so they don't happen. There are some instances like that. Virginia passed a hybrid commission a few years ago when the Democrats barely came in and did it, and it was the sort of constitutional reform that required some legislative approval. So, you know, it is possible to get it done through a legislature, but by and large, I think it's not blue states as much as ballot initiative states where it's happening.
Now, Seth, so many of the stories that have come out about gerrymandering, particularly following the 2020 census, seems to be state draws districts, judge throws it out, and then the state has to go back to it. I know there have been some cases where the state just keeps presenting the same maps until finally the judges get tired and we get close enough to the election, they have to accept that. That raises the question again about drawing the districts, that state legislatures or different commissions might be charged with drawing those districts, but the judges do have quite a bit of say in this. How has that power relationship played out in, particularly in 2020 or the post-2020, the post-census?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you think about it, because again, you had some standard for what a partisan gerrymander would be. But the standard was set so high by the Supreme Court that it really was irrelevant. And so now when you look at fights over redistricting, they are happening at the state level on a state-by-state basis. And then it's, okay, well, what's the composition of the court, right, in that state? Is it aligned with the party that's drawing the boundaries or not? And so then you can get a lot of these disputes that are, you know, within the state. Interesting, like Christian, for example, from North Carolina way back in the day, and North Carolina repeatedly has been redrawing its congressional boundaries because the court will intervene and then it gets overturned. And so this sort of thing is happening. And you're right, it's very strategic in the sense that, okay, you know, how close is the election as we go through this litigation? And then does the map have to hold for one cycle and then be, you know, thrown out the next one? So these are the kinds of things we're seeing all the time. And the other thing that we're seeing in the last 10 years, the most recent round of redistricting, is that voters, because they've become more polarized and sorted into partisan camps, they're not as flexible now when you change boundaries. So unlike when the South was realigning in the 90s, where you weren't sure what you were going to get, now when you draw these gerrymanders, they're much more predictable. And so now if Democrats or Republicans have control of gerrymandering, they just go to the wall with it and with the expectation that even with a short-term partisan tide that might push in the opposite direction, it's very likely that their map isn't going to give up many seats to the opposition.
There's one last sort of big topic I want to make sure that we get in. Christian, I'll ask you first. I know there's been this this perception that gerrymandered districts are producing known outcomes so that the primary is actually the real election in a lot of these districts. And then you could see, because you only have to appeal to your, you know, to your base, that it's leading to extremism in politics. It's fair to say gerrymandering is responsible for the partisan divide and these appeals to a bit more extremism.
Yeah, so there's a debate on that among political scientists, and most political scientists don't think gerrymandering has a huge role in extremism. I do think you can use redistricting, though, to enforce party discipline, and I don't think scholars have studied that enough. So, you know, if you take a look at the people who get screwed over by their own parties in redistricting processes, they tend to be the people that don't vote with the party. You look at Oregon, look at Illinois, not Oregon. Look at Illinois, and the Democrats were in charge of the Illinois redistricting process this go around. And there were two Democrats put into districts together, and one of them happened to be somebody who challenged another Democrat in the primary the previous election. So you have, there is a little bit of redistricting that does help enforce party discipline that I think we need to think about. But you know, there's been increasing polarization in the Senate as well, and the Senate isn't subject to redistricting. And so a lot of political scientists say, oh, it's not necessarily redistricting, but redistricting may be helpful in certain ways to enforce party discipline. I do think, you know, if you do draw deep blue or deep red districts, though, it does make it easier for people to be effectively winning without any serious opposition in the general election. So then it really does mean the primary does draw people to the left or to the right. So it's not redistricting per se, but there is a component of the primary being the key election that could lead to polarization.
And Seth McHale, I'll give you the last word on this question. Should we be concerned about extremism in politics on the basis of this process of redistricting?
I'm sort of with Christian on this. You know, what we've seen in American politics and where we've gotten to this point, you know, some of us say, you know, we're tribal now, right? We sort of just tune out the other side if it's not our party. You know, it took decades for this to happen. And so, you know, I think redistricting, maybe it was an accelerant at times, but overall, I think, you know, the Senate is the great example to use as a foil, because again, we don't redraw states. And yet we look at polarization measures, voting records in Congress, and the Senate's caught up with the House. And so there's not much daylight between them in terms of polarization on partisan lines, regardless of congressional chamber now. So I don't think it's really, it's more of a symptom than a cause, I would say. But certainly if you're drawing districts that are, 70% blue or red, there's really no incentive at all for that member of Congress to even think about, bipartisanship or trying to come to the middle. So that's true, too.
Seems like one of the core challenges, and you both have raised this, is this process of redistricting, this process of gerrymandering, is allowing representatives to choose their voters. And that in and of itself has some profound implications for democracy. But I'm pretty comfortable saying this is not an issue that's going to go away anytime soon. And we can see quite a bit of this development. We've been discussing the history of and the impact of gerrymandering, the ways in which districts are drawn, particularly salient considering we've just had a census and a redistricting and we have this upcoming midterm election. Our panel today has been Seth McKee, professor of political science at Oklahoma State University and the author of The Intersection of Redistricting, Race, and Participation, and Christian Gross, professor of political science and public policy at the University of Southern California, the author of An Independent Redistricting Commission's Increase Voter Perceptions of Fairness. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Ranked choice voting is meant to ensure any election winner has a majority of votes. How does it work? And how did it affect recent elections in Alaska and New York City? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In the current U.S. system of governance, single representatives are elected in each district or state. But if more than two candidates run for the position, the election is often won by a plurality rather than a majority. Many constituents have chosen a type of voting system to ensure that the elections are won by a majority vote, called ranked choice voting. In this program, Doug Becker explores this process of voting, ranked choice voting, explaining how it operates and what results we can expect from its use.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel is Rich Barton, assistant teaching professor at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University and research fellow at Unite America. He is the author of How Challenges in Primaries Shift the Policy Agendas of Political Parties. Joseph Cole, visiting assistant professor of politics at Sewanee, the University of the South. He is the author of Demographic Disparities Using Ranked Choice Voting, Ranking Difficulty Undervoting, and the 2020 Democratic Primary. And Todd Donovan, professor of political science at Western Washington University. He is the author of Changing How America Votes. Thank you all very much for joining us. Joseph Cole, I'll ask you the first question. There's this thing out here called ranked choice voting. What exactly is ranked choice voting and how has it been applied in the U.S. and possibly, comparing it in other places?
Yeah, so you started off with a pretty good explanation. It's an alternative way of electing individuals where instead of just casting your vote for a single individual, instead you'd rank all of your choices from, most preferred to least preferred. Now, if the first ranking goes by and nobody gets 50% of the vote, then it goes to a second election, kind of, where now whoever had the least amount of votes is kind of kicked off the ballot And everybody who listed that person as their first vote, they then get to have their vote transferred to the second person in line. And this kind of continues up until somebody finally receives a majority of the vote and they end up winning the election. This has been spreading kind of popularly around the United States. There's been several cities that have had this for, you know, several years now. But of course, you know, Maine just recently enacted RCV for some of their elections, as well as Alaska. And it's definitely becoming more and more popular in recent years.
And Todd Donovan, what's the motivation to moving from kind of a traditional plurality, so-called first past the post, I guess, or to ranked choice voting?
There's several. There's the one of the main ones maybe is that it could mitigate the spoiler effect where you have somebody, you know, running as a third or fourth candidate and getting just enough votes to have somebody win that most people probably, you know, that the majority didn't necessarily approve. You know, something we maybe see with, you know, whoever gets the most votes, but not necessarily a majority in, say, presidential elections. But I think one of the more promising features of it is I think there's pretty good data on this. It changes the incentives that candidates have when they campaign. So it maybe, you know, kind of changes the tone of a campaign where instead of just rallying your base and bashing your opponent, a lot of candidates are going to realize that they need support, you know, second choice, third choice rankings from their rival, you know, the supporters of their main rival. We've done some research that shows voters' perceptions and candidates' perceptions in cities that are using ranked choice voting are that the campaigns are less negative. So I think that's one of the more promising features of it. And also that maybe, you know, it might give space for candidates who today wouldn't run because they don't have a base on the left or a right to rally, and maybe give some space for candidates who can reach out to voters from all over the spectrum by, you know, building coalitions, appealing for second choice, third choice preferences. So I think, you know, those are maybe the two that come to mind to me most immediately as far as reasons why people might be motivated to look at this.
And Rich Barton, Todd Donovan suggests part of this is about negative versus, you know, more positive campaigning. I know you've written about partisanship and kind of partisan extremism as well. Ranked choice voting offer a promise that trying to overcome some of the extremism that we've seen in some of these primary challenges?
Well, we have limited data points to look at, but up to this point, I think that the evidence is promising. So if you look at the Alaska race that you mentioned at the beginning, you know, Sarah Palin was in second place after the first round when votes were tallied. But the Republican Party as a whole actually had the majority of votes. And what happened was about a third of Begich's votes, the third place finisher in the first round, ended up going to his Democratic opponent. And I think there's a solid argument to be made that because Palin was such a negative campaigner, because she was such an extreme figure and took such a pro-Trump position, that she actually lost a lot of moderate Republicans that she might have otherwise won over and didn't need that many more to win the majority. So when I look at that, I mean, and we might have this was a special election. We might have another election very soon in a few months. We're gonna replay and see how political learning might have taken place over the last few months and if Palin and other candidates change their strategy.
I think one of the great ironies, Joseph Call, with all of this is that after that election, Senator Tom Cotton suggested that Palin lost because ranked choice voting was undemocratic or it somehow created an outcome that Alaskans didn't want. But the purpose of ranked choice voting, at least broadly, should have produced a victory for Palin, even though she finished second, you know, with sort of first place votes. So how democratic, you know, is that process, I guess? You know, does ranked choice voting distort democracy or does it enforce democracy?
It's more complicated than that. A lot of times, especially when you look at how people are voting and how they're ranking, there is one kind of attack that people have against ranked choice voting, which is this idea that if I ranked a couple candidates, I ranked three candidates, but then none of my three candidates end up in the last election, that head-to-head that chooses the 50%, then they kind of argue that that's a way of distorting my vote, that I didn't get an actual say in the election. But that's also kind of akin to me just not voting in the first place. So if we had four candidates, I only like three of them, so I only ranked three of them, then hypothetically, if it was up to that fourth candidate, I wouldn't have voted for that fourth candidate anyways. So it's a little bit more complicated than just the results are kind of let on.
Todd, what makes the Alaska case so fascinating then is that you had multiple candidates from political parties, didn't really have a primary system at all, right? And so does ranked choice voting replace the primary, or what's the relationship between ranked choice voting?
It varies a lot depending on the jurisdiction. So the Alaska model, and that's is sort of similar to something that's on the ballot in Nevada this year, that they have a primary that, I mean, when they do normal elections, we'll pick top four. In Alaska, it's the top four that come through ranked choice voting, and they'll be on the general election. And in Nevada, I believe it's going to be five. But in a lot of cities, you know, one of the ways this has originally been rolled out and the way it works in Australia is you don't need a primary. And this is how it's been used in some municipalities, that it's a cost-saving thing. So you can just do, and they used to call it instant runoff voting. It's you know, it's the same thing as ranked choice voting. That was the way that was sort of marketed by reformers as, you know, this will save you money not having a primary. But no, so it's the Alaska and the Nevada ones are interesting because they've opened up the primary, but the primary is not, it's no longer the party picking their nominees. It's whoever are in the top four, the top five coming out of the first round go on to the ballot in November. But I think, you know, the Alaska one, we could, you know, people get fascinated by that because it involves Sarah Palin. But, you know, most of the time in the United States and Australia, it's the person who is first in the first count, the plurality leader in the first count, is the eventual winner. That's what happened. New York City last year had the biggest ranked choice voting election in the country. And Eric Adams was ahead in the first round. He you know, preferences transferred and he won. So that, you know, at the end of the day, we get a lot of the same winners, you know, left or right, regardless. But it does, it changes that dynamic. And it does occasionally create this situation where we see somebody maybe who is in second or third place getting elected. But the Alaska case is pretty typical. It's the Democrat was ahead in the first round and, you know, would have won a special election if it was a one-off and won on preference transfers regardless. So in that sense, I think you're asking, like, does it, how do you say, dampen democracy? It's at least in terms of outcomes, it's not that much different.
By the way, to follow up on that, in areas where we've had ranked choice voting, is it typical that candidates might actually try to form alliances to convince their voters, not just who to pick first, but second, third, you know, fourth? And so therefore, you could even possibly encourage multiple political parties and pre-election party alliances?
Yeah, we saw a little bit of that in New York in 2021 with Yang and one of the other candidates you know, appearing together and at least one of them saying, give us our second preferences. We've done surveys of candidates in US cities where about a third of the candidates are saying they're out there asking supporters for their second choice or their third choice. So yeah, you see those coalitions and voters, you know, the exit polls we've done in New York show the voters are, they're hearing, you know, at least a third of them say they're hearing candidates say, hey, give me your second preference. So that's what it gets into the, you know, you maybe get most of the time the same winner, but it really changes the dynamic of how people act and work together in campaign.
Doug, can I respond to your prior question on the relationship between the primary reform aspect of Alaska and the ranked choice voting in the general?
Absolutely, Rich Martin. Go ahead.
Great, thanks. So in addition to what Professor Donovan was saying, you know, I would add that so these reforms do not necessarily go together. We see plenty of places that have reformed the primary system, made it more open, or completely eliminated partisan primaries altogether. So Alaska's, you know, a recent example. We see it in the states of Washington and California, and actually the state of Louisiana eliminated partisan primaries in the mid 1970s for pretty interesting idiosyncratic reasons. And for a lot of advocates of ranked choice voting, The emphasis is on the lack of competition in the general election, in particular advocates who focus on ranked choice voting in general elections, like we see in Alaska. And so for those of us who are really worried about partisan polarization, there's a question of to what extent is polarization today a feature of competition between the parties in general elections being less and less competitive over time? We know that, right? Mayhew famously coined the term the vanishing marginal districts. So there's fewer and fewer competitive seats at the general election level. But then there's also more competition in primaries, and more specifically, competition that tends to come from the ideological extreme. And so some advocates for primary reform will point out that, ranked choice voting in the general might be a nice complement, but really the solution to polarization is in reforming and maybe just eliminating partisan primaries. And I think that there's some great new research coming out by Sarah Anderson, Laurel Harbridge Young, and Daniel Butler, who recently put out a book. And what they find in their recent research is that if a incumbent is equally likely to lose a primary as they are a general, that they're going to prioritize the challenge in the primary election. And the reason for that is that what we know from a wealth of political science research is that what tends to determine competitive general elections is the short-term economy and the president's approval rating at the national level. Things that are pretty independent of the behavior of an incumbent legislator. Whereas in primary elections, advocates, donors, and primary voters tend to pay more attention to the specific legislative behavior, which I think seems to point in the direction that what's happening in the primaries is really important. So that's a long way of saying that I think the relationship between primary reform and ranked choice voting in the general is complicated. And sometimes the advocates of each are pointing towards different problems.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the practice of ranked choice voting and its impact on elections with Rich Barton of Syracuse University, Joseph Cole of Sewanee University, and Todd Donovan of Western Washington University. So, Joseph, I know you've written quite a bit on the impact that ranked choice voting has on issues like voter turnout. Do we see, I know there's not a lot of data out there yet, do we see, and what's the theory behind that ranked choice voting could actually get more people to the polls?
Yeah, so I think prefacing it with the fact that there's not a whole lot of data out on the effects of ranked choice voting on voter turnout. But I did have a paper that myself and a colleague from UW Stout, we looked at how ranked choice voting affected youth voter turnout in a local election. I did find that it did increase youth voter turnout a decent amount. But studies that tend to examine ranked choice voting and turnout tend to typically find no effects in the general population. We kind of attribute these effects for youth because under ranked choice voting, candidates have an incentive to, as Dr. Donovan was mentioning earlier, kind of expand their base past the usual people they're contact and try to rally. Young individuals oftentimes are also not contacted by campaigns or candidates because they're young, they're not going to vote, that whole idea. Now, under RCV, it might incentivize greater contacting of people you usually wouldn't contact in order to increase your first, second, third choice rankings. And so you kind of hypothesize that this might lead to increased contact amongst young individuals, which would get them to turn out. And additionally, some prior research, like Dr. Donovan was saying, does show that ranked choice voting elections might be a little bit more civil than non-ranked choice voting elections. And young generations, particularly millennials and Generation Z, they've kind of grown up in an era of really negative and hyper-partisanship. And a lot of studies suggest that they're kind of turned away from politics. So we kind of also investigated whether or not this increased civility might also be kind of resulting in young individuals being more willing to participate in elections. Now, the study ends up finding that the civility angle doesn't have a lot of explanatory power for why young individuals were more likely to turn out, but that contacting argument, that had a lot more evidence suggesting that there might be, greater greater incentive for candidates to reach out to individuals, including young individuals in RCV elections than in plurality elections or other types of elections. But again, this research is not definite yet, and more work needs to be done in this area.
So in essence, you're saying because there's an interest in trying to get voters, trying to be the second choice, you know, even if they're not necessarily the first choice, the candidates are just reaching out to communities they would typically write off if there was no ranked choice voting. And young voters are sort of at the top of the list of just, you know, communities that they would write off. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely something along those lines, that they know that they need to widen their base in order to get people who might rank them second or third, even if they're not their first choice. And so they might try to find people who maybe are less likely to be turning out in the first place in order to boost their own numbers.
Todd Donovan, I was thinking about this when broadly thinking about ranked choice voting, that one of the greatest disincentives for third parties, for independents or third parties to run, is they can act as spoilers and actually, you know, have the exact opposite effect than, you know, they wanted, particularly if they're running. I think of Liz Cheney's discussions about running for president to keep Donald Trump from winning. In a ranked choice vote, though, does that create an additional space? So it's not just the possibility of more moderate candidates, but just an additional space for additional parties. Is this a pathway out of the party system?
Yeah, and it is, we got to remember, this is a majoritarian system. It creates a majority winner, but it gives third parties or independent candidates some influence that they wouldn't otherwise have. Like, you know, you're Ralph Nader in 2000, you're a pariah for affecting the election result. But in Australia and in places that use this, their parties or candidates that might regularly, you know, be eliminated in the second round or third round, but they can demonstrate that, you know, my preferences, that candidate's preferences transferred in mass to the eventual winner. And that gives them influence and leverage to be able to say, you know, you need to take us seriously. You need us to be able to get reelected. So it you don't really see that many, I'm just the Australian case, you don't see that many more. There's a few minor parties that get in there and few independents, but the real role for the smaller parties is, you know, making deals, coalitions in terms of how are they going to tell their supporters to who they're going to rank second or third. And that has huge implications on who ends up winning. We don't have that in the winner-take-all system. It's just you run, you maybe affect the outcome and piss people off.
And if I could just follow up on that, the Liz Cheney example is actually really interesting in this case, because I think there's a lot of people, you know, on the left and in the center who think Liz Cheney would be a great spoiler to Donald Trump. I was actually at a talk recently by Fred Luntz, a famous Republican pollster who's now in the election reform circles. And he was talking about how he's done polling and finds pretty convincing evidence that Liz Cheney is much more likely to pull votes away from Democrats and left-leaning independents, and is much more likely to be a spoiler for the Democratic candidate. And interestingly, if we had ranked choice voting, you would imagine that whatever votes Cheney would have stolen from the non-Trump candidate would have gone to that candidate.
Now, actually, I'll ask all three, but I'll start with Todd Donovan. You referenced Australia. What other countries use ranked choice voting, and have we seen any sort of trends?
Yeah, there's actually a category. When we say ranked choice voting, we're usually talking about these single winner races, but there's two forms of it. One is you can have multi-candidate races where there's a proportional version of it. That's used in Australia for the Senate. The single winner is used for the House in Australia. The multi-candidate version is used in Ireland. And as we all know, it's used in Malta as well. That's a joke. Nobody knows anything about Malta. So at the country level, those are the three places that use it. But there have been, you know, in the United States, there's been the multi-candidate versions of it. And in Canada, you know, back in the 1920s, there was a movement kind of during the Progressive Era where people were exploring these election systems. But it's really recently, you know, in the last decade or so, that we're seeing it emerging now at the local levels in the United States. But Australia's been using it for 100 years. So that's kind of a go-to for some background on how it's been working.
And from your comments, seems to suggest that it actually doesn't have all that much of an impact, or at least an impact in the sense that the second place finisher somehow can leapfrog the first place finisher because of ranked choice voting. That is actually quite...
Yeah, that happens occasionally, but yeah, the vast majority of the time, it's who's ever ahead in the first count wins the seat eventually. In these single, again, so you know, we talk about ranked choice voting as, are we using it just to elect a single seat? Then that's the case. But Portland's got a version on the ballot right now, which is a proportional multi-member thing where that's a completely different ballgame. Same ballot, you just rank, but then there's a way to apportion that proportionally. So multiple candidates are winning. So, but you know, depending which type of ranked choice voting we're talking about, it provides different opportunities for smaller parties, mm-hmm. but more than they probably have under any sort of winner-take-all system.
Rich Barton, there's been a suggestion here. I mean, there's areas where they're starting to adopt more of this. Is this going to be a feature that you see growing in the U.S., or is it going to still be pretty small number of, you know, of jurisdictions, a pretty small number of elections in a ranked choice?
I think it's something that we're going to see growing, and I wouldn't have necessarily said that 2 years ago. And certainly not 5 to 10 years ago. And I think, you know, I'm teaching a class on the policy process right now. And one thing that we know that advocates, a sort of clever technique that advocates will do, and I don't mean this in any sort of cynical or negative terms, but they will have this sort of pet policy project that they develop and they research and they develop an infrastructure around it. And then they will capitalize on a salient sort of event and able to sort of leverage the infrastructure and the knowledge and the community to affect change by sort of sneaking in through that event that is related, but maybe, you know, tangentially related. And what I'm speaking to is, you know, January 6th and Trump's refusal to cede power after the valid loss of 2020 presidential election, and would ranked choice voting? There's other sort of more direct solutions, but the concern, the salience of Americans' concern about the health of democracy is heightened, which makes me think that this is a really real opportunity for election reform advocates who have different sort of alternatives in mind that maybe aren't a direct response to that, but that fit within this broader theme of democracy reform.
But Joseph Cole, when I think of that, and I understand this sense that Americans are just kind of exasperated about their, you know, about the status of the democracy generally and want to see change, I'm drawn back to Senator Cotton's comments about the outcome in Alaska. And I suspect when he said that it was this strange, undemocratic voting system that resulted in Sarah Palin's loss, that what he was actually doing is relying on just general misunderstanding or lack of knowledge about ranked choice voting. Anything new that produces something that seems strange must be undemocratic. How much is that a hurdle for advocates for ranked choice voting to just be able to explain it in a way that will build a constituency for it?
I do think that's a little bit of a problem. It's slightly more difficult to explain ranked choice voting than it is a plurality election or majority election. And it goes not only to the difficulty of explaining it, but also the difficulty of using it. I'd say there's maybe mixed evidence on whether or not it's more difficult for voters to use ranked choice voting than it is to use plurality or majority voting. And anti-RCV advocates have kind of tried to grab that potentially increased difficulty of RCV to argue against it, saying that it's not only be non-democratic, but it also might be difficult for voters to utilize. Now, there's kind of evidence on both sides showing it is a little bit more difficult, it's not more difficult, so it's mixed right there. But it's difficulty of understanding, implementation, counting, and things like that definitely prevents a pretty big burden on RCV advocates' side who are trying to push for RCV, because it is a little bit more difficult to explain, telling people how the ranking process goes, how candidates are eliminated, and all of that.
And Ty Donovan, I'll give you the last word on that question.
It is potentially, you know, marginally more difficult for voters to go 1, 2, 3 than just one. But, you know, I've done a lot of exit polls, and most recently in the New York City election, and 90%+ of people say the instructions are easy to understand. 80% of people want to keep using ranked choice voting. So they had a nice, robust voter education campaign. So those whatever marginal complexity this might add is pretty easily dealt with.
And so it seemed that the more familiar, more often it's used, the more familiar voters we will get with ranked choice voting. So as a potential election reform, that in and of itself could predict at least some growth, if nothing else, some interest. And in that spirit, I want to thank all of you for giving us some insights as to how ranked choice voting has worked, what the impact has been, and just, you know, elevating the discourse so that we can all just sort of understand it better. This has been really quite informative. We've been discussing ranked choice voting and its impact on American democracy, its impact on American elections, and something we can watch very closely in the midterms, because obviously some very important elections are going to be using ranked choice voting. Our panel today has been Rich Barton. He is an assistant teaching professor at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University and a research fellow at Unite America. He's the author of How Challenges in Primaries Shift the Policy Agendas of Political Parties. Joseph Cole, visiting assistant professor of politics at Sewanee, the University of the South. He is the author of Demographic Disparities Using Ranked Choice Voting, Ranking Difficulty, Undervoting, and the 2020 Democratic Primary. And Todd Donovan, professor of political science at Western Washington University and the author of Changing How America Votes. Thank you all very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.